If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Do you love true crime? Do you want to work with your favorite podcasters? Then True Crime Podcast Training might be just what you're looking for. True Crime Podcast Training prepares you to research and write for true crime podcasts with 100% online coursework taught by leading true crime professional Haley Gray and certified teacher Andrea Marshbank. As a creator, I rely on solid research for putting episodes together, and you may recognize Haley's name from the show notes of many, many already gone episodes. At True Crime Podcast Training, you can benefit from Haley's 7 years of experience and Andrea's knowledge as a professional educator. They offer personal instructional coaches and networking opportunities are available. You can choose the course option that benefits your learning style. Take a look at their online programs by visiting truecrimepodcasttraining.com today. That's truecrimepodcasttraining.com. And you can use code GONE for $150 off any course.
Jennifer vanished sometime in the overnight hours.
Right now, there is no trace.
Investigators say evidence leads them to believe that she's dead.
Stick my nose back in the trail. That's all I can do.
This is already gone.
Already gone.
Already gone.
On a late spring evening in 2017, a tearful young woman entered her local sheriff's office, asking to speak with detectives. She was afraid for her life and claimed to have been keeping a horrifying secret for months. Within minutes of her confession, a murder investigation began, and the lives of three families were forever changed. Come with me to Macomb County, Michigan, where a conversation between friends would uncover a devastating betrayal of trust and 13 long months of deception. When Stephen Christopher McAfee was born on December 26, 1996, the holiday period became extra special for his parents, Suzanne and Michael. Stephen was the youngest of three children, and his older siblings, Catherine and Jonathan, were equally as delighted with their new baby brother. Catherine would carry Stephen around everywhere she went, and Jonathan quickly became Stephen's best friend. The two were raised to always look out for their little brother, and they did so throughout their lives. From a young age, Stephen loved music. Before he could speak, he would vocalize the opening notes of "We Will Rock You" by Queen. This passion continued throughout his life, and when he wasn't listening to music, he was creating his own on the drum set in the basement. Stephen was a talented artist, and he used both music and art as a way of expressing himself. His family always encouraged him to pursue his ambitions and believed he had a bright future ahead of him. In addition to his talent, Stephen had a brilliant sense of humor. Catherine describes Stephen's ability to crack a joke during the most inappropriate moments, or how he would use a whipped cream can or his armpit to make fart noises at family dinners. His laugh was contagious and would quickly spread around the room, even if the joke wasn't funny. His family also remembers Stephen for his kindness and his love of animals. He'd spend hours in the garden playing fetch with the family dog and would go to sleep each evening with the cat, Sally, curled up nearby. Stephen's father, Michael, recalls a time he and Stephen had gone fishing together and Stephen had caught a large fish. Instead of celebrating the catch, Stephen noticed the fish only had one eye and asked his father if they could release it back into the water. During his early years, Suzanne and Michael began noticing subtle differences between Stephen and his peers. Stephen would eventually be diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a now-retired diagnostic term for high-functioning individuals with autism. After he was diagnosed, Stephen began to fear that he would be looked at differently by those around him. His quiet nature meant he was reluctant to defend himself against school bullies, and he struggled to make and maintain friends throughout his childhood. His sister explains that Stephen's friendships would eventually fizzle out due to differences in maturity. His friends would stop contacting him and would no longer ask him to hang out, and Stephen would be left feeling alone. During this period of his life, he spent a lot of time with Catherine and would confide in her about how he felt. She said it was at this point that she really began to enjoy Stephen's company. Outside of his family, the only consistent relationship that Stephen held throughout his life was with a friend named Andrew Fiacco. The pair had met when they were 5 years old at Ebling Elementary School, and they shared special education classes for a few years. They then continued their friendship outside of school due to the proximity of their homes and mutual friends within the neighborhood. Andrew was also diagnosed with autism in his early years, and Stephen gravitated towards him as a result. However, to Stephen's family, it quickly became apparent that Andrew was a bad influence. Catherine said, "If you loved Stephen, he loved you even harder." This notion, along with his inability to maintain friendships, made it easy for Stephen to be taken advantage of by those around him. He was a people pleaser, and he would do anything Andrew asked of him. Andrew introduced Stephen to illegal substances and would encourage him to do things that he usually wouldn't. As Stephen couldn't drive, the pair would often disappear together in Andrew's car. Stephen would forget to check in with his parents to let them know where he was going, leaving his parents panicked and afraid for his safety. Eventually, the boys began getting into trouble, and Andrew would use Stephen as a scapegoat to absolve himself of blame. The relationship between Stephen and Andrew began to break down in early 2016. When Stephen made a heartbreaking confession to his mother, Andrew Fiacco had sexually assaulted him, and he was afraid of what people would think, or if they would begin to question his sexuality. After hearing this horrifying revelation, Suzanne and Michael McAfee told Stephen that he was never to see or speak to Andrew again. Although Stephen had just turned 19, he still lived in the family home and was expected to follow their rules. Despite this, Stephen found it difficult to give up on the friendship he'd had for many years, and Andrew repeatedly found new ways to contact him without Stephen's parents knowing. In addition to Stephen's diagnosis of autism, he was also diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He would struggle to express his feelings and had periods where he would lash out in frustration. In February of 2016, Stephen packed a bag and left home following a disagreement with his parents. However, it didn't take long for this issue to be resolved. Within 2 weeks, Stephen had moved back in with his parents and sister. Upon return, Suzanne and Michael hoped that Stephen's behavior would improve and that Andrew would no longer be a negative influence in his life. Andrew was not allowed in the McAfee home, and as far as they were aware, the boys had stopped communicating completely. Sadly, they would quickly learn that they were wrong. Just days later, on the evening of Wednesday, March 9th, 2016, Susan McAfee arrived home after a long shift at work. She was greeted by Stephen, who was lying on the couch texting friends and watching television. After speaking with her son for a short while, she decided to go to bed. It was at about 9:30 when she told Stephen goodnight and left him to continue watching TV. A few hours later, Stephen's father returned home from work and noticed that Stephen was still awake on the couch. They had a brief conversation before Michael had also decided to go to sleep. By all accounts, Stephen was his normal self, and his parents assumed he would go to bed in the early morning hours like he often did. When Suzanne woke up around 6 a.m., she carried out her usual routine of checking the house to ensure that everyone was home and safe. She quickly realized that Stephen wasn't there, and she woke Michael to tell him. Initially, they assumed Stephen had gone out with his friends and forgot to check in, and they texted him numerous times that morning asking him to let them know that he was okay. Suzanne headed into work as usual, but felt in her gut that something wasn't right. Every time she called Stephen, his phone went straight to voicemail. By the evening of Thursday, March 10th, he still hadn't responded to messages or returned any of the calls made by his worried family. The next day, Suzanne logged into Stephen's online phone records to see if she could gather any information about where he was or who he'd been talking to. She quickly learned that the last call made from her son's phone was to Andrew Fiacco at 3:17 a.m. on March 10th. His phone had been turned off hours later and had never come back online. Using this information, she reached out to all of Stephen's contacts to see if anyone had heard from him. Michael decided to search all the places in Macomb County that his son would frequent, such as local vape stores, fields, or other popular hangout spots nearby. These repeated attempts to find Stephen were unsuccessful, and his friends hadn't heard from him for several days. As the 48-hour mark began to approach, Suzanne decided to reach out to Andrew Fiacco, but he repeatedly declined her calls. She sent the following text at 10:21 p.m. "Andrew, this is Mrs. McAfee. No word from Stephen since Thursday morning. We have tried him every day. His ex-girlfriend said he was on Snapchat Thursday morning in a grocery store goofing with carts. Do you know where he would be? Has he contacted you? He has turned off the phone." Minutes later, Andrew replied. He told Suzanne that Stephen had FaceTimed him at 2 a.m. on March 10th, and they'd had a brief conversation over the phone. He then explains that around an hour later, he'd received another phone call from Stephen, who asked Andrew to turn his car around as he had just driven past him. According to Andrew, he picked Stephen up, said hi, and gave him a high five. Andrew then explained to Stephen that they couldn't hang out together anymore and he needs to start checking in with his parents. Finally, he says Stephen left the vehicle and began making his way to another friend's house. Andrew ends his message telling Suzanne that he is sorry they are unable to get in touch with him, but he does not know where he is. After reading his long rambling text, Suzanne became even more concerned. She had initially reached out to Andrew on Thursday afternoon, along with many of Stephen's other friends, and he'd already claimed they hadn't spoken in weeks. Suzanne then replied, "We need to know if you know anything. He could be in serious danger. We don't think you are telling us all that you know." Again, Andrew responds, quote, "I can screenshot my phone history. You'll see that I miss his phone calls most of the time because I ignore them. And I told you I'd stop talking to him in respect of you. If any time I did accept the phone call, it would be for less than a minute conversation, and I'd just be explaining to him that we can't talk anymore." Suzanne replied, "Andrew, cut the bullshit. You know the reason you and him were not allowed to hang. This is a serious matter, and if you know anything, we will find out. We are giving you the opportunity to tell us first." Suzanne and Andrew continue to go back and forth for several minutes. Suzanne repeatedly asks Andrew why he lied when she spoke to him on Thursday afternoon, and Andrew claims that he can't remember speaking to her that day. He explains that despite his past, he has become a better person and has hope that he can create a successful future for himself and his girlfriend. As Suzanne continues to question the story that Andrew is telling her, he eventually gets frustrated and snaps. He said, "I sincerely and do genuinely care about your son's well-being. I remember all the dumb, irresponsible decisions he'd make in the past. Only God knows what kind of decisions he's making now concerning that he won't go to therapy sessions or get the help he needs, like you stated in our phone conversation. It's not my fault that you don't know where he is, and you're trying to put it on me." He then ends the conversation, claiming that he has company over and will no longer be rude by spending time on his phone. By Saturday afternoon, Suzanne and Michael decided they had waited long enough and contacted law enforcement to report Stephen as a missing person. Deputy Charles Mishakis was dispatched by the Macomb County Sheriff's Office and responded to the family home at around 4 p.m. After hearing the concerning details, a missing persons investigation began, and officers carried out an emergency ping on Stephen's phone. They learned it had connected to towers in both Detroit and Sterling Heights in the early hours of Thursday, March 10th, but had not been active since. Officers also visited the location where Stephen had stayed 2 weeks prior when he left home voluntarily, but there was no trace of him. By March 14th, Stephen's image began circulating online along with pleas for information. He was described as 19 years old, 6'1" with a slim build, brown hair, and brown eyes. The days continued to go by with no update, and Suzanne began combing through online responses to look for any information that might be of use to the police. Very quickly, she discovered comments that Andrew Fiacco had made on the Click on Detroit Facebook page discussing Stephen's disappearance. The first comment said, "This guy right here was my best friend in the entire world. We've had our negatives in our past, and it led us to stop talking to each other and seeing each other. He will always be my best friend to me. Not even my best friend, he is family to me. He is like a brother to me." The second comment, made a few days later, said, "I wish I knew where he was. I would have told authorities already. He had a problem with checking in with his parents or anyone, including me. I'd give him fatherly lectures about how he needs to check in with his parents before he goes somewhere or does something. Never did he do any of those things, though. I miss him so much." The tone of his comments caused concern for many, including Suzanne. She began searching through Andrew's social media profile, looking for anything else he may have posted about Stephen. She then noticed that Andrew had removed all images of Stephen from his Facebook profile, making it look like the two were never friends. Suzanne informed investigators of her suspicions, and Andrew quickly became a person of interest in the case. And listeners, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Answer. On March 16th, 6 days after Stephen's disappearance, Andrew was questioned for the first time by Detective Mark Morfino. He was advised that he was not under arrest, so he could leave at any time. During questioning, Andrew claimed he hadn't seen Stephen in person since February 29th. He explains that he'd had an argument with his girlfriend in the early hours of March 10th and had left the home to go for a long drive. When he returned and his girlfriend asked him where he'd been, he told her he'd been with Stephen as he didn't want her to think he was cheating on her. He then felt he also had to lie to Suzanne McAfee, so his story was consistent. Despite his insistence that he was now telling the truth, Detective Morfino felt that Andrew Fiacco was withholding information. He continued to press for answers, and Andrew began fidgeting and drinking water excessively. Detectives asked him why he was nervous, and he said it was because he felt like he was being accused. Finally, Andrew was asked if he had attempted to contact Stephen since he'd vanished, and if he had managed to get in touch with him. Andrew responded, saying that he hadn't, as he had already been informed that Stephen's phone was switched off, so he didn't see the point. Despite his odd behavior, detectives did not have probable cause to detain Andrew Fiacco, and the interview quickly came to an end. Before leaving the sheriff's office, Andrew assured Detective Morfino that he would contact him if he learned anything about the disappearance. Weeks went by with no developments, and Stephen's parents began fearing the worst. Stephen did not have a bank account, so was unable to support himself financially, and he hadn't accessed his social media accounts since March 10th. The police investigation continued, and a reward of $2,500 was offered by Crime Stoppers for information that could lead to Stephen's whereabouts. The McAfees began sharing flyers that were provided to them by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they engaged in local press releases to keep Stephen's case fresh in people's minds. Suzanne says that the behavior was so out of character for Stephen, she felt the only explanation was that he had fallen victim to human trafficking or was being held captive somewhere. She could not rest without knowing where he was, and she pleaded with the public for help. Michael McAfee began calling morgues in the area and would check if Stephen's description was a match to any unidentified remains. He also continued looking in the areas that Stephen frequented, hoping to spot him riding his bike or hanging out with friends. In August of 2016, months after his disappearance, the Macomb County Sheriff's Department issued another appeal for information, alongside an increased reward of $5,000. Susan was quoted as saying, "As a parent, your child is always connected to you, no matter if they're gone and living their dream. Stephen was a very young boy. His life was just beginning." She confirmed that there were no issues on March 10th, and he hadn't made any preparations to disappear. Meanwhile, detectives were becoming increasingly aware of Andrew Fiacco due to his troublesome behavior. He was brought to the sheriff's office a second time on September 12th regarding an unrelated offense, but was briefly asked about Stephen during this interview. Before questioning began, Andrew informed detectives that he had received legal advice and would not be answering anything that may be accusatory. He also stated that several topics regarding Stephen's disappearance were off limits. Detective Morfino asked Andrew if he had heard from Stephen in the previous few months, or if he'd heard any local rumors about what had happened. Andrew claimed the last time he'd heard from Stephen was the 3 a.m. call on March 10th. This time, instead of claiming to be Stephen's best friend or brother, Andrew described the relationship as a burden and indicated that Stephen would call him incessantly. When detectives asked what Andrew believed had happened, he said Stephen had likely run away due to his spontaneity and he had probably changed his appearance. Andrew also agreed that Stephen could have been kidnapped due to his vulnerabilities. Again, it was clear that Andrew felt uncomfortable in the presence of police, and his fidgety behavior continued to raise eyebrows. As Andrew was now refusing to answer any questions that could assist police in locating Stephen, the detective had no choice but to let him leave for a second time. The investigation continued throughout the year, but Detective Morfino had already exhausted all viable leads, and information from the public had slowed considerably. As the first anniversary of Stephen's disappearance came around, his family had begun to lose hope. They were frustrated with the lack of answers, and their devastation could be felt throughout their pleas. After two more agonizing months, their greatest fears were confirmed. At around 8 p.m. on April 26, 2017, a young woman named Cecilia entered the Macomb County Sheriff's Office with her father. She claimed to have information about a missing person and asked to speak with a detective. Within minutes, the pair were escorted into an interview room by Detective Derek Elsie, and Cecilia broke down in tears. She explained that she had information about Stephen McAfee and told Detective Elsie that she believed he had been murdered. As the detective was unaware of Stephen's case, he asked Cecilia to explain what had happened. Cecilia claimed that her friend, Yvette McDonald, had confided in her about 4 months prior, in January of 2017. Yvette told Cecilia that her boyfriend had shot Stephen, and she had helped him to dispose of the remains. Detective Elsie asked Cecilia who Yvette's boyfriend was, and she responded, "Andrew Fiacco." When Detective Elsie asked Cecilia why she hadn't come to police sooner, she explained that she was afraid of both Yvette and Andrew, and feared for her own life. On the evening of April 26th, Cecilia had finally told her father what she knew, and he had brought her to the police station immediately. Detective Morfino was then alerted to the development and quickly made his way to the sheriff's office. He asked Cecilia to repeat the information she had given to Detective Elsie, and officers began attempting to locate the whereabouts of Andrew Fiacco and Yvette McDonald. At 3:15 a.m., Andrew was located at a substance abuse rehabilitation center in Warren, Michigan, and was arrested before being taken to the Macomb County Sheriff's Office. Upon arrival, Andrew was placed into an interview room and detectives read him his rights. When asked if he knew why he was there, he initially assumed it was due to recent charges filed against him for an attempted shooting at a bank ATM. Detective Morfino asked him to think about what would be serious enough for them to drag him out of bed at 3 a.m., and Andrew replied, "About Stephen?" Eventually, detectives told him they had discovered new information that suggested he knew more than he initially claimed. Andrew continued to deny any involvement in Stephen's disappearance, but admitted to lying about seeing him in the early morning hours of March 10th. He said Stephen called at 3 a.m. and asked him to pick him up so they could smoke pot. He claimed he drove to Stephen's house, gave him pot, and then dropped him back off at home. Detectives told Andrew they knew this wasn't true and informed him that they had been given information by Yvette McDonald. Andrew then realized that the detectives weren't bluffing, and he added more to his original story. Now, he admits that prior to picking Stephen up that night, he'd gone into his brother's room and decided to borrow his gun for protection. After picking him up, he drove Stephen to a wooded area on 34 Mile Road near Van Dyke Avenue to give him the drugs. When asked why he chose that location, he said it was because it was close to home. He says that when they arrived, Stephen wanted to get out of the car to search for Nancy's grave. Now, Nancy's grave is a local legend about a woman's grave hidden deep within the woods. So the pair began walking through the dense woodland, and Stephen noticed that Andrew was carrying a gun, and he grabbed it before pointing it at him. The pair began to wrestle, and Andrew claims he distracted Stephen before grabbing the gun back from him. He says that as he grabbed it, the gun accidentally discharged, and Stephen was shot in the stomach. Andrew said that he panicked as Stephen fell to the ground and stopped moving. In that moment, he decided to leave Stephen and quickly made his way back to his car so he could drive home. As questioning continued, Andrew insisted that Stephen had attacked him for no reason after the exchange of marijuana. He indicated that he feared for his safety, but did not mean to shoot Stephen, and stated that only one shot had been fired. Detective Morfino advised Andrew that they'd know where Stephen was shot and how many times he was shot following autopsy. Andrew changes his story again and admits that he'd shot Stephen 3 times. He explained that when Stephen was shot in the stomach, he panicked because Stephen had tried to get up and he knew that he'd retaliate. He then shot him 2 more times in the back to make sure he was down and out. He also finally admitted that he'd shot Stephen in the stomach intentionally, as Stephen had climbed on top of him when they were wrestling over the gun, and he felt it was the only way he could get him off. When detectives asked what he had done with Stephen's body, he claimed he had left him in the woods for around a month before he'd enlisted the help of Yvette McDonald. The pair had carried a duffel bag with them, but quickly realized they wouldn't be able to take Stephen's whole body. Andrew claims that Yvette had separated Stephen's body in half using an axe because he wasn't able to do it. However, he had gathered some items from Stephen's remains, such as his vape, phone, and wristwatch. He admitted he wanted to keep these items as souvenirs to remember his friend. Andrew then claims that he and Yvette had placed Stephen's lower half into the bag and drove it back to his house, where it was placed in the trunk of Yvette's car. The pair then returned to the woods about a month later, and Andrew used the hook of an axe to remove Stephen's skull from his upper torso. He claimed he had to look away while doing it, so he wasn't certain which parts of Stephen's body he had collected. Again, He says the remains were placed in a large bag and taken to Andrew's home. By the time they returned for a third time, Stephen's torso was gone. His body had remained exposed in the woods for almost 3 months, and he assumed that animals had carried away the rest of the remains. Finally, Andrew admitted that he and Yvette had buried Stephen's remains in the yard of his family home before burning the bag they'd carried the remains in. Although Andrew had implicated Yvette in the dismemberment of Stephen's body, he confirmed that she was not there when Stephen was shot, and she had only found out what he'd done weeks later. Overall, this interview lasted 2 hours, and Andrew had changed his initial story a total of 6 times. He was booked into jail soon after, and Detective Morfino requested a search warrant for the Fiocco property. At 7 a.m. that morning, Suzanne McAfee got the call she'd been dreading. Detective Morfino informed her that he had received new information about Stephen and asked her to make her way home from work so he could speak to her and Michael in person. As Suzanne rushed to gather her things, her nose began pouring with blood. She was in shock and too distraught to drive, so she had to receive a ride home from one of her coworkers. During the journey, Suzanne called Michael to let him know what was happening. Once arriving home, Detective Morfino informed the McAfees that Stephen had been murdered. Immediately, Suzanne asked him who was responsible, to which Detective Morfino replied, "Who do you think did it?" She asked, "Andrew Fiocco?" And he told her, "Yes, you were right." The McAfees were also advised that investigators were going to be searching numerous areas to recover Stephen's remains. This news caused even more heartache for the McAfee family, as they came to the realization that Stephen's body had been mutilated. Soon after, officers began making their way to the Fiocco residence on Kunstmann Road. The medical examiner, Dr. Spitz, was also informed and arrived on scene at approximately 9:40 a.m. As the search began, several areas of interest were identified for further investigation. At the back of the Fiocco property, officers located a large slab of concrete buried inches below the surface of the ground. As the concrete was lifted, they discovered the lower half of Stephen's body, as well as his jeans, socks, and shoes. Upon recovering the remains, Dr. Spitz discovered several identification cards belonging to Stephen, still contained in his pocket. The team then moved to the second area of the garden described by Andrew during his interview. However, due to several patches of disturbed ground, they were unable to determine an exact location to dig. At 10:25 a.m., Detective Morfino visited Andrew in jail and requested his assistance at the scene. Following a brief conversation, Andrew agreed to help and was recorded on police body cam, calmly directing the search team to the precise area where they would find Stephen's skull. He was then escorted to the wooded area on 34 Mile Road, where he walked officers to the scene of the initial incident. There, he points to the area where Stephen's body had laid for 3 months and gestures to the general location where more remains may be found. The search team at the Fiocco home began excavating the new area indicated by Andrew and located a pair of headphones encased in a large circular concrete block. As no visible remains could be seen around this item, Dr. Spitz carried it inside of the property and began rinsing it under water to remove outer debris. As he did so, he noticed a set of human teeth emerging from the concrete, and the item was placed into evidence soon after. Dr. Spitz then made his way to 34 Mile Road and discovered that more remains had been collected. The team had located Stephen's lower jaw lying among the undergrowth, as well as numerous vertebrae, ribs, shoulder blades, collarbones, and arm bones. After several more hours of searching, the remains from both locations were gathered and escorted back to the medical examiner's office. The next day, Suzanne McAfee shared the devastating news with those who had been following Stephen's case on Facebook. She said, "It is with great sadness we share that Stephen's remains have been found. We thank everyone who has helped us spread the word and have kept Stephen in their thoughts and prayers throughout this past year. We ask that you please continue to do this for Stephen as well as his family and friends. Within hours, the Detroit area became more aware of the horrors committed by both Andrew Fiacco and Yvette McDonald. In a press conference conducted by County Prosecutor Eric Smith, he announced that charges had been filed against both teenagers for their involvement in the disappearance and murder of Stephen McAfee. 19-year-old Andrew Fiacco was indicted on a 4-count felony charge, including murder in the first degree, felony firearm charges, mutilation of a body, and lying to police. 18-year-old Yvette McDonald was also charged with mutilation of a body, accessory after the fact, and lying to police. On April 28th, the pair appeared in Romeo District Court, handcuffed and clad in white and green striped jumpsuits. Neither offered a plea and decided to stand mute as advised by their attorneys. Judge Dennis DeLuck listened as Mark Morfino outlined the case and the confession made by Andrew Fiacco. He admitted they had not yet determined a motive for the crime and were awaiting autopsy results to confirm Fiacco's story. Finally, Prosecutor William Cataldo argued that Andrew Fiacco should be held without bond due to the depravity of his actions and lack of remorse demonstrated over the previous 13 months. The judge agreed. When discussing the involvement of Yvette McDonald, the prosecutor commented that he would not be against Yvette being released on bond, as it was her confession to a friend that eventually led to Stephen's body being found. Yvette's attorney, William Barnwell, also argued for a bond to be offered. He claimed that Yvette was just a month away from graduating high school and posed no risk to the community. As the arguments concluded, Judge DeLuck agreed to offer Yvette a $20,000 cash bond under the condition that she would wear a GPS monitor and would avoid any contact with Andrew Fiacco or his family. Soon, Dr. Spitz began the lengthy process of extracting Stephen's skull from the concrete cylinder it had been encased in. Throughout the process, he located several rib bones contained within the cement and retrieved Stephen's headphones for further examination. After the removal of all remains, Dr. Spitz was able to make an official identification using dental records. He also discovered that Andrew had lied to the police. When retrieving and cleaning Stephen's skull, Dr. Spitz discovered 2 bullet wounds which were previously concealed. One bullet had entered under Stephen's right eye and had exited through the top of his head. The other had entered the back of his head and traveled to his left cheekbone, becoming wedged in the skull. Dr. Spitz retrieved the bullet and informed the Macomb County Sheriff's Office of his findings. As the examination came to an end, all of Stephen's remains were placed together, and it quickly became apparent that several bones were still missing. Despite extensive searches of the 34-mile property, these additional remains have never been found. On the 7th of May, a vigil was held in Dodge Park in Sterling Heights to remember Stephen for the talented young man that he was. His friends said they had decided on the location because it was one of the places that Stephen loved to hang out. Crowds of people gathered to show support for the McAfee family, and together they shared memories they had of Stephen. As Stephen's family anxiously waited for justice to be served, Andrew's defense team began filing numerous motions to have incriminating evidence suppressed in court. In one motion, they argued that Andrew's confession should be thrown out, as his repeated requests for legal representation were ignored during questioning. The court agreed to review the footage and eventually made the decision that the interview was able to remain in evidence. During this time, Yvette McDonald had also come to a plea agreement with prosecutors, where she agreed to testify against Andrew in exchange for a reduced sentence. We will be back in just a couple of days with part 2 of this episode. I'm your host, Nina Instead, and as always, I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.